Merħba għal program Minajnejn Barrani fejn jiena kol il-Fitz niltaqa' u niddiskuti pajjiżna ma' diversi persuni ta' nazzjonalitajiet differenti li għal xi raġuni oħra għamlu lil Malta id-dar tagħhom. Il-programm jixxandar kulna ta' tlieta fit-tminja ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu, kif ukoll jinstab fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM. This week in the program, I'm speaking to Bruce White. I won't say where he's originally from, because he's actually lived in many different countries. So I'm going to leave it up to him to describe exactly where he's from or what nationality he considers himself to be. What I will say is that he's a professor of anthropology, but it's much more than that that he does. So I'm very, very honored, and we're very lucky to have him on the program, because I think in the context of Minajnejn Barrani, Malta through foreign eyes, Bruce can give us some information about Malta through many different foreign eyes rather than just one pair. So, Bruce, straight to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you've lived, and what you do.
Well, thank you, Colin. Yes, as you had said there, I am confused about my own identity and where I'm from, and that's partly good for me because that's the work that I'm most interested in, is to look at other people's identities and to work out how they connect themselves to the world and to different ideas about country and culture. I'm originally from, I was born in Britain, but my family were Irish and American, and I, at about 2 months old, went to Nigeria and was there until 4 or 5, and then moved from Nigeria to the United States, and was on and off in the United States for a decade or more, and apparently, according to my parents, I'd lived in 13 countries by the time I was 3. So very mixed ideas of where my heritage is from and where I belong in the world.
Were your parents in the travel business, in the military, in the diplomatic service?
My father originally was in the military, but when I was 4, he gave that up and ended up working for a branch of my mother's family that were in the United States. I was moving between different family groups from a young age, Britain and America mainly, through my early years. So that was how I ended up all over the place.
And there's other countries you've lived in as well. I believe that before the interview, when we were chatting about the interview, you mentioned Japan.
Yes, I did my... In order to become an anthropologist, you have to live in a place for a year or more to do field work or research. And I chose at 22 years old to do that research in Japan. And that was about 20 years ago. So ever since that research, I've had a long relationship with Japan, and I have lived there in an employment capacity as a professor of anthropology in Japan for the last 10 years, and I was there in my early 20s for 5, so a big chunk of time there.
And your career is?
Well, I started an organization called the OICD, which is the Organization for Identity and Cultural Development. I started that when I was in my mid-20s, so that's about 15 years ago now. And that organization works to understand how identity, and particularly cultural identity, how people feel and think about who they are as cultural beings, affects them in everyday life. And particularly we work in conflict areas where people are fighting each other because they're trying to protect or advance the cause of their cultural identities, and so we try and give an analysis to that. And that was complementary to my understanding and interest in anthropology more generally, so that's been ongoing for the last 15 years.
And how did you find yourself in Malta?
Well, I first came to Malta as part of a sabbatical, which is a year where academics are encouraged to work on projects that they haven't had time to work on because they were teaching. And so that's how I first came here. And the idea was that I would be closer to family than I would be in Japan, but also close to some of the projects that we have ongoing in the organization I represent, some of them in North Africa, former Yugoslavia, and other places throughout Europe, so I've only been here for about a year.
And where are you living here in Malta?
I live in the Three Cities area.
And why did you choose Malta for that reason?
Location aspects were important, and also I think the first ethnography, and ethnography is a work that an anthropologist produces the first time they, not necessarily the first time, but when they study a culture, they produce what's known as an ethnography. Sometimes they can be novel-like books. Ethno means a group of people or an ethnicity, if you like, and ography is a study of, so an ethnography is a study of a group of people, and the first one I ever read as a student was A Village in Malta.
Oh.
By Jeremy Boissevain,
the famous Dutch academic who passed away not long ago.
That's right. And I think that had always been in the back of my mind as the first ethnography I'd ever read and became close to in terms of perspective. And I had a year to basically live wherever I wanted. So Malta stood out for that reason, and also the reasons of location that I spoke about. I didn't necessarily want to be in somewhere I already knew. So there were lots of factors, but those were probably the main ones.
And how did this particular chapter or dissertation or study by Jeremy Boissevain come into your hands, wherever you were at that point in your life?
Well, A Village in Malta, the ethnography, is, at least when I was a student, was taught to first-year anthropology students.
In
Durham University, where I studied. Mm-hmm. I think it was, and still is, a classic ethnography in the sense that many ethnographies of that time, today we're a bit more dynamic as anthropologists and we might write about all kinds of things, but when I was a student, the ethnographies were still about one place in the world, and A Village in Malta was almost a perfect study, if you like, on one community of people through a cycle of seasons and events, and of course it covered things like festas and just the general clock-like tick-over of a year or more, I think, as I remember, in the village that was covered. But I think that the perception of Malta as small is, of course, one that people living here, even myself, have started to adopt. But there are many connections with the world. I would say, for instance, that from a Japanese perspective, rather than any other perspective, the Japanese know Malta in their minds very well, because it was featured, not just because of this, but one of the reasons is that it was featured in a very famous novel about in the 80s. That people still read today, and it has an imagery of the Mediterranean, from the Japanese perspective, a very sort of romantic imagery of an island in the Mediterranean, exotic island.
I believe you're talking about the British author who lived in Gozo, who wrote, was it Man on Fire, or who based his character, this adventure, swashbuckling character. He had lots of adventures around the world, but he always went back to his base, which was in Gozo.
I'm actually thinking of the Murakami, Japanese novelist, who wrote, I think it's called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicles. Yeah, it was a Japanese writer who's still active and very famous worldwide. A recent book was IQ84. Some of your listeners may have heard of that. I think I've got the name wrong, but... Murakami, who's a very famous Japanese novelist, his novels are translated into English and many other languages, had written a book in the 1980s called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicles, and one of the characters was very connected with Malta, and I think their nickname was Malta. That's in the Japanese mind, at least, imagery of the Mediterranean is strong with Malta. So, in fact, I've had several occasions where I've been talking to Japanese friends who have known and understood Malta compared to, say, other European friends, maybe British friends, who necessarily couldn't put it on a map.
Right. You were looking around for a place to do your sabbatical, have your time in your sabbatical, and you decided on Malta. Had you ever been here before, or did you come here, do a recce, a reconnaissance, and then decide to come? Or did you just say, no, it's Malta, and you came here and had everything prepared and stayed?
I did do a recce for about 5 days, and I stayed in an Airbnb place very close to where I ended up buying a house in the Three Cities. So it was a kind of, I'd already done a lot of research on Malta, in terms of whether it was a place I'd enjoy spending time, and I wanted a connection to Europe that would hardwire me into Europe in many ways, and to, as I mentioned before, some of the project areas that I'm interested in, North Africa and so on. So it was a real investment, both in making an investment in a small house that I've bought, but also an investment in a society. And so I did a lot of research. And one of the things that made me very encouraged that Malta was a vibrant place that I would enjoy on many different levels was seeing a documentary, I think it was YouTube. And I haven't watched it since, but I'm almost sure that you and many of the cast from Comedy Nights, or at least some of the cast, were on there as media people, as people that were expressing an interest in critiquing and commenting on Maltese society. It was, as I remember, a documentary that was flagging up 2018 as Valletta's City of
Culture
in Europe. And I just remember seeing all of these people, mainly younger people, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, talking about Malta in a very positive but critical way, and thinking, wow, there's a really vibrant community of commentators, if you like, on Maltese society, and that gave me an extra boost to think that this was a place that I would enjoy.
So what you're saying is, when somebody's doing research on Malta, all kinds of things come up on the internet that we might not know or think that would be interesting to people from the outside, and yet they are. And you never know what's being seen and what people are thinking. It's way beyond the old-fashioned view, okay, we're publicizing Malta as beaches and sun. There's so many people out there who are looking at Malta through the doing their research and finding things that we wouldn't know or think would be interesting to them, but they are. Bruce's reference there to the Comedy Nights is the fact that in my spare time I take part in theater and drama and comedy shows, and Bruce actually came along to watch one of the shows, and that's how we met, so thank you for that. So you did your research and you came for the 5 days to Malta, and what were your first impressions when you came off the plane and the first 24 hours?
Well, I was taken straight away to the Three Cities where the Airbnb was, and so my impression was very influenced by the beautiful architecture of that area. And I, in the early 2000s, lived in Venice, and now that I live there, it's very normal to me, but at the time it struck me as a kind of a Venice that was not quite as polished, which I loved, because Venice is over-polished and a bit of a Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And but the Three Cities area is so beautiful architecturally, and with the new Dock One development down there, it's really a wonderful place to be. So that was my first impression. And then the real estate agent that I was working with to find a small house there in the Three Cities started driving me around to other areas, and places like Salima, and places that were much more modern, if you like, and those places seemed very, very interesting and new as well, but very different from the Malta that I'd had a first impression of coming straight from the airport. I arrived at night, so you can imagine that my waking up in the Three Cities area, right in the heart of Kospikwa, as it turned out, was my first impression, and then everything else looked very modern after that. So my first impressions was of a place that was very ancient, if you like, very interesting, very Baroque, and I still probably haven't lost that impression. Even today, having spent a year and traveling around the entire island, it's the that sort of historic architecture that still interests me, and I find wonderfully enriching.
And was there a particular factor that made you decide, yes, this is the place for me for the next year or so?
I think as soon as I arrived in the three cities, I thought this is more than I ever expected. I particularly love that kind of architecture and the look of the place and living somewhere I think that represents a mix of all of the influences that Malta has had over the years, for good or bad. It feels like the best of all of Europe and North Africa, and that's very much in tune with identity issues that I enjoy. So I was sold on it within a 24-hour period.
You must find this thing we Maltese have, this sort of north-south divide, if you want. I know that the people who live in the three cities, for example, in the different... even in the individual three cities, they are very, very proud. And sometimes they have a bit of a fortress mentality against the Sliema people or the St. Julian's people or the Valletta people or the people from the north of Malta who they perceive as looking down on them. So the people from the south, particularly the three cities, feel themselves to be forgotten sometimes, not enough investment in the area, sometimes looked down upon. And the people of the north are a bit perhaps intimidated. They feel the people from the three cities or the south are, for want of a better word, this is not me speaking, but what the perception is, lower class or perhaps violent. This must be really interesting for you, but have you experienced it in other countries as well? Is it a uniquely Maltese phenomenon? What are your thoughts and comments?
Well, this is an area that I find interesting wherever I go live or study, and it's very universal. It's incredibly universal. And I've happened to have lived, as I said before, in Venice. I've lived for a long time in Kyoto, which is a kind of Japanese Venice. My mother now lives near Winchester, which is a very historic, it's the former capital of Britain, if you like, of England, before London. So these old places I'm very familiar with, and I've often thought that they have way more parallels between them than they do with neighboring cities in their own countries. So people from Venice or from Kyoto or from Winchester have more in common with each other than Kyoto has with Tokyo, or Winchester has with Birmingham, or Venice has with Milan. And so I look at these issues of status or class or identity in very universal terms. And the north-south divide in Malta is a necessary evil in any society. And I have very close friends in Kospicua, where I live, who, it could be said, feel that they have a particular way of looking and feeling about Malta that is perhaps different from people from Sliema. You know, these sort of issues of identity and the way that it fractures people within societies is something that you see everywhere. And of course, in every place, we would hope to dismantle those walls and those divisions. But that's certainly one that exists in Malta, isn't it? And the more I live here, the more I'm understanding what it's about. Of course, like many, many other Maltese people are... communicating with people from all sides of different divides, including that one, and see some of the nonsense of it.
Is a lot of it nonsense, do you think? I mean, should we all be concentrating on the fact that we're all Maltese and geography shouldn't divide us, or is it, does it go deeper than that?
Well, it's a deep question. I mean, I think it's, of course, when I say nonsense, it's artificial. The real divisions are between opportunities rather than different sorts of people. But that's, again, the same everywhere. I work in conflict resolution, as we've talked about, and in conflict resolution, these issues become issues that people kill each other over, therefore they're much more dangerous than they would be in somewhere like Malta. But anywhere you see all kinds of missed opportunities, and it's not that we should or must pursue an identity that brings us all together, but if we don't, we miss opportunities. And I think those opportunities are across many levels. We miss economic opportunities. The more that we see divisions in our society, we perhaps don't make economic connections to people that we consider not to be us. We don't make social connections, and we don't feel politically empowered. So we miss opportunities. And that's the same everywhere. The North-South divide in Malta is one example of how it works in the world. And rather than talk about the importance of bonding and unifying, which can be a kind of almost too empty an idea, I think it's more interesting and accurate to talk about missed opportunities.
Let's talk a little bit about your world, the work you do in the world, your organization. Which are the biggest issues that your organization and you yourself have worked on, have tackled? You said the North-South divide in Malta is like a microcosm of bigger issues in the world. These kind of issues always start with something that we see, like the kind of thing we see here in Malta, but eventually in bigger countries, in bigger societies, divisions between ethnic groups or groups of people from different levels of society can lead to death and destruction. So which are the biggest issues, world issues, that you have tackled or looked at or worked on?
Well, some of the issues that are very clearly important now are to do with the radicalization of people into terrorist organizations. This isn't necessarily new, but it's new in the scale at which it's covered in the media. It's new in the particular blend of religious fanaticism that accompanies it. Also, some of the issues with migration that we see on the news are current and interesting. These issues at their heart are all about identity and our willingness to, I think, in both of those issues, whether it be the radicalization of extremists or the ability to accept outsiders as your own people, they're issues that challenge us to think about who we are and who our societies can include. And I say that with reference to terrorist recruitment, particularly because a lot of the people that we see at the end of a terrorist action, we trace their identity roots back to them not feeling included in their own societies, to being marginalized. That's the case in France, for instance, with many of the terrorists that have gone out to commit acts of terrorism. So issues of identity, issues of belonging and or lack of belonging are often at the heart of all of the world issues that make the news. That's why it's interesting for me to be where I am in looking at these issues, because in a way we look at the DNA of conflict. And we try and understand how it gets to where it gets to. And almost in every case, we see that issues of belonging and identity, people just not feeling that they have a stake in a place or in a community, is the genesis or the trigger that leads eventually to them committing acts of violence. But that's not limited to terrorism. You see it in every single place, and
social unrest, perhaps, as well.
I was going to say, mm-hmm. places like Ukraine and a lot of the Arab Spring movements, mm-hmm. Underlying those movements are issues of identity. So it's very interesting for me to be able to have an analysis on that dimension of people's lives, because I believe it's at the core of what eventually triggers large-scale unrest or violence. And even small-scale discrimination, as we see across Europe with the migrant issue.
So you feel that these smaller groups, these people who feel marginalized within larger societies, going back to the word opportunities, you feel that they don't have or have not been given or have been stopped from having opportunities to develop and be fully integrated and be fully participate fully in their society, whether it's a relatively new society that they've moved to or whether it's their own society that they live in.
Yes, I think that we often look at the world in terms of economic or political involvement or opportunity, but there is an invisible layer of social belonging and the ability for us to feel that we can connect socially that is very difficult to see, it's invisible, but is incredibly important to people. And one of the things that all societies do is to make some attempt to allow outsiders to fit in, to assimilate, or to find a place for themselves. And in many cases, Malta included, some of that works very well. But it's often a layer that we don't give as much analysis to as we probably should, because it ends up being the layer of existence that can propel people, compel people to violence if they're not feeling that they belong in many ways. So it's a particularly important area to focus on.
And how can or how has your organization and your work helped to make all this better, to smooth things over, to move to the future, a better future for all concerned?
Well, one of the things that we feel is important to do is to connect a very academic, research, theory-based understanding of the world to very practical, applied ways of messaging to reach people. And to go back to some of your work in the media and in theatre, particularly with satire and reflections on how society works from a satirical, comedic view, those views of society, those mirrors on who we are as people, are incredibly important. And so what we try and do is connect quite a complex understanding of how the world works to vehicles, to troops like Comedy Nights or other playwrights or media troops of any kind, to ways in which people can receive ideas about who they are. We try and connect those two worlds and empower people to have more choice about how they think about themselves. Because often in societies, both societies in conflict and societies not in conflict, you find that people's choices to imagine who they are in the world have been limited in many ways, and that comes back to opportunity. If we all had unlimited opportunity to imagine who we were in the world, we would have a massive portfolio of ideas that would allow us to be whoever we wanted to be. But in almost all societies, those ideas have been chipped away at by politicians, by people from all walks of life that have tried to channel our ideas about who we are into narrower understandings. And so as an organization, we're very interested in coming into particularly places where there's active violent conflict and working out how those ideas have been limited, sometimes directly manipulated, in order to get people to fight for a cause, to believe that they are one race or one ethnicity or one religion, and therefore they should harm the other people, and to regenerate ideas about who they are so that they can move out of that rather entrenched, restricted view.
Qegħdin tisimgħu il-programm minn għajnejn barranin fuq Campus FM li x-xandar kulnarta tlieta fit-tminja ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu kif ukoll jitstab fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM. I'm speaking to Professor Bruce White an anthropologist who's currently based in Malta. We're recording this interview for Campus FM's Minainen Baranin, Malta Through Foreign Eyes. And we're recording this interview in January of 2016. Now, Professor White, Malta, we do have a sort of calm existence, at least at the moment. We went through our ups and downs in the post-colonial period, but overall, not too much violence, not too many deaths, no war, thank goodness. Each country of the world, each region of the world, at some point or another, experiences some sort of upheaval or perhaps regeneration or development. At the moment, we're going, like Europe, through a phase of having migration issues. People or perhaps groups of people are coming to our country and being incorporated, some from countries in Eastern Europe, some from the European Union, some from North Africa, some from the Middle East. Some of them are what's seen to be legal, some of them are what seem to be illegal. Do you see, through your experience of looking at and trying to resolve or help resolve conflicts in other countries where there have been violent issues, violent results out of the lack of opportunity for certain people who have not felt integrated enough, do you see that Malta could ever go through this unless something is done now? Malta could face problems in the future. Do you think enough is being done? What do you think Malta's direction is when it comes to different cultures in one society here?
I don't believe that Malta is in danger necessarily of entering into a state of internal conflict. And from what I've observed on a day-to-day level, integration here works relatively well. I would go back, though, to, and I would say this about any society, not just Malta, there are many opportunities, and perhaps I see increasingly Malta is offering more opportunities than many other societies because of its history, because of its location, to present an example of how this could be done to other European countries. And that's not often, I think, recognized in other countries too, the capacity and potential of places. I think Malta, because of its size, perhaps has a smaller view of its potential contribution to Europe as a whole or to the world. And I see it, as I do many countries that I look at, I understand the potential in terms of identity, because that's what I'm interested in, and that's what I analyze. And Malta's potential to offer Europe with a unique combination of ideas and narratives and histories that could weave people together in interesting ways is huge. And I think that beginning to move towards fulfilling that potential would be an interesting trajectory, an interesting path for Malta to take. Whether that's on the cards politically or socially for Malta is a different issue. But I see that potential, and I think it could be an incredibly powerful example to some of the much larger countries in Europe and further afield of what can be done with a country that has such an incredibly rich past and that has brought, not of its own accord necessarily in many cases, but has, of course, brought all the cultures of, or many of the cultures of the world into its sphere and created a society from that mix. So I would emphasize the fact that there isn't an imminent danger. Malta does very well, I think, on the ground with integration, but just like in many other societies, there are lots of opportunities that can be chased up, and perhaps more than many other countries in Europe. There's a huge potential for Malta to contribute a unique combination of ideas about what it means to be part of the world, and I would find that very interesting to see happen.
this question of integration. It seems to be happening of its own accord without any clear plan or long-term plan for integration. It's good that you see that there doesn't seem to be any problem and that there hopefully won't be any problem in the future. But from my point of view, from my perspective, when it comes to integration, particularly with the cultures that are not similar to ours, let's say the African cultures and the Middle Eastern cultures, the Muslim religion, there doesn't seem to be much direction coming from above. Not because people don't want there to be, the people in charge, the authorities. It seems to be more, to me personally, the way I see it, that they don't really know what to do or how to handle it. But yet, thankfully, people seem to be integrating because the Maltese people are hospitable in general. There's little friction so far. Do you see it in that way as well, or do you think that there is some kind of unseen hand guiding things?
No, I think that's well said. I mean, I think in many societies, in most societies, that this is the case, that people get on with life on the ground. And, you know, we are, as human beings, very conscious of our own diversity, and somebody coming with different cultural values from the outside, as we've said before, with the, let's say, the north-south divide in Malta, can sometimes appear more similar to us than people from our own society that we don't consider to be one of our own. So we have an incredible human capacity to deal with and prosper under diversity and the challenges that it brings. But I think it's well said that many governments, well-meaning governments, find it difficult to grapple with these issues on a policy level. And that's not because they're not well-meaning or they're not clever or anything like that. It's just because these issues are very complex. And we find as an organization that, you know, that's one of the areas that we're needed most, is to help governments to work out the kind of things that they could be doing to allow this grassroots, everyday level integration to be even more effective and to have a say, a positive influence on what's happening in their own societies. And again, it's a question of not a question of them not caring or not wanting to better their own societies, but just to, these are complex questions, and when it comes to setting a direction, whether it be policy making or whether it be just messaging to their own populations, governments find it difficult to know what to say, how to deal with it. So that's one of the areas that we work quite closely to help people in those positions to come up with a strategy.
Remind us, what's the name of your organization for those people perhaps who haven't been listening to the program since the beginning?
So we're called the Organization for Identity and Cultural Development, OICD.
And you're present in how many countries?
Well, we have representatives in about 20 countries or so, but we are, the people that belong to the organization are represent many more countries than that, but the organization is primarily based in, well, I'm in Malta, and I'm connected to University College London, and we also have a presence in Japan in terms of administration.
Now, as a person who specializes in studying identity and the concept of identity, what's your overall view of the Maltese identity, with all our foibles and our good points and our, you were talking about how different classes or different sectors of the Maltese population might feel they have more in common with an outside cultural identity or a foreign person than they do with someone from their own country, from a different part of the country. The famous Hamali and Plebs and Pepe, there is this this divide in Malta. What's your opinion as an outsider who has been living among us of the Maltese identity?
Well, as you say, Colin, I mean, it's very, in any society, and including Malta, once you start analysing things from an identity perspective, you realise how many different identities exist. And so it becomes almost impossible to talk about a Maltese identity because you begin to reveal all of these different structures. And I'm very new to Malta, and so I'm only just beginning to understand the distinctions between the identities that you've just talked about. But it's always been my experience that very, very quickly in any society, one of the first things, as anthropologists actually, that we're trained to do is to be very conscious of beginning to look for these divisions of identity. And that, conversely, has the effect of allowing you to get to know and love a place. Just like you get to know and love a partner or somebody who's close to you, you begin to reveal all of these complexities and things that in the beginning you thought this person was wonderful, and sometimes, you know, there are things that stand out and you think, well, that's wonderful too, but that's different. And that's a bit like getting to know a society. So a relationship for me with any society is about understanding these different complex nuances and complexities, and Malta hasn't disappointed.
To go back to the bigger picture, do you think that the concept of nationalism, of us all being French or German or Maltese, will one day soon disappear?
Well, that's an interesting question, and we as an organization often, and as academics of course, look at these questions. When I was starting the organization that I now represent back about 15, 20 years ago, many of my academic colleagues were looking to a world where there would be no nation. They were looking to a world where we would all be global citizens and there would be no national identity. And I always used to think that was incredibly optimistic, and I still think that. I think that the nation state, Malta, France, Germany, whatever, is going to remain with us for a very, very long time. I don't see it fading, certainly not in our lifetimes, probably not in our grandchildren's lifetimes, and probably not for a long time after that. The nation is a very appropriate container for our projections of ourselves in the world, and you don't get rid of something that works easily. And so I don't see that fading, although I would say that the shape of the nation can change. Even 60 years ago, in some of people who are still alive today would have seen the nation state as a much more structured unit than we do today. People would fight and die for their nations in a way that I think many of us would find challenging to do today. So nations, how they're thought about, how we think about our place within them can change, but I don't in the immediate future see a big movement away from them.
And back to Malta, on a personal level now, Bruce White, the man. Maltese social life, Maltese foods, Maltese festivities and things that we do, festas, fireworks, going out. What are your favorite things about Malta when it comes to living among us?
Well, I think, as I was saying before, it's like having a new relationship and getting to know society in all of its complexity is exciting. And I suppose one of the things that I'm enjoying a lot at the moment is the increasing familiarity that I'm getting in somewhere like the Three Cities to the way in which places outside of the South, the North I suppose, operate and function, and I'm really enjoying understanding these differences. I think that there's a lot of incredibly rich culture in the South, if you like, in the Three Cities that I've yet to experience, but I'm going through that. I've been in the South now in Kosciuszko for a year, so I've now gone through an entire cycle of festas and events, And I'm only just beginning to understand the Malta outside of that. That's becoming very interesting too.
So you don't have a commute to somewhere, to the university or somewhere where you do research? You spend a lot of your time within Caspiqua and the Three Cities area?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I'm getting more and more familiar with the way that people and communities function in that part of Malta. There's a lot of diversity there. It's fascinating, as there is everywhere. But as many of your listeners will understand, it's a very vibrant place to be. And understanding how that area is different from other areas that I'm beginning to become familiar with in other parts of Malta is fascinating to me.
But pleasant.
Yes, of course, of course. And I'm sorry, I'm not giving you very concrete examples here, but I can't think of... I mean, the difference between we're looking out at St. Julian's and, you know, the tower over there, it's almost, you know, it's so different from that part of Malta, which is more sort of connected with, say, the tourist industry or the modern industries of Malta. There are many Maltas, aren't there? And I'm enjoying understanding that in a deeper way than I did when I first arrived.
Yes, we're conducting this interview with a wonderful vista in front of us. We're actually in the Excelsior Hotel. I managed to pin Bruce down after a few weeks because of his very busy schedule. So yes, we have a wonderful vista of Sliema and St. Julian's beyond and the Manuel Island, Tajbish, which is... anybody would say is different from the views he has from Bormla, from Caspiqua, where he lives. But nevertheless, the views there are also spectacular and interesting. What about the Maltese language? Have you felt have you had any problems communicating with the people where you live and work because of your lack of understanding of the Maltese language? And have you picked up any of it while you've been here?
I haven't had any problems communicating with people, having lived long term in a country where my first language wasn't spoken by the people in Japan, learning Japanese, I feel I've not been able to do as much as I should be doing in Malta with regard to learning the local language of many of the people that I'm surrounded with. I am beginning to pick up some of the nuances. In Japan, it was quite interesting. When I first lived in Japan, they have words that are fill-in words. So in English, we might say are. And in Japan, of course, there are words that fill in. And one of the first things I picked up in Japan was some of those sounds that filled in gaps, and I'm slowly starting to pick those things up in Maltese too. But oosh, is that
right? Oosh, yes, and the mela and
all those kind of words that you can mix in.
Speaking
in English, but mixing those words in to kind of connect with the Maltese culture rather than just be speaking English as almost a neutral language. So I'm looking forward to knowing more about that and being able to use those little words.
a little comparison perhaps between your life in Malta, your day-to-day life, and your life in, let's say, Japan, for example. We haven't tackled Japan in this series yet. I haven't spoken to anyone, a Japanese native who lives in Malta, so perhaps you could stand in for them for the moment. Your average life in Japan and your average life in Malta, how do they compare?
Well, they're actually quite similar. I mean, the daily routine is quite similar. I live in Malta in a quite a tight-knit community where I know my neighbors,
are your neighbors locals or international people who live in Malta?
Locals. When I walk out of my house to go to the local cafe for a coffee, I may see two or three people that I'll say hello to, and that's very similar to the life I had in Japan. So I wouldn't say there's too much in the day-to-day feeding of what it means to have an existence in Malta versus Japan, but of course there are many differences that people would see if they were suddenly thrust from one place to another.
Are the Japanese as legend portrays them as being very, very efficient and getting things done quickly? Surely that's different from what happens here in Malta.
Yes, yes, but it would also be efficiently done, but more expensive than Malta. Okay. But but yeah, yes, I think there is a big difference with regard how service works, if you like. Japanese are very customer orientated, and I think Maltese companies in general are not exactly as set up as the Japanese companies that are very ultra efficient. But I've actually found with in dealing with daily life in Malta that people tend to be you might be kind of taken aback for the first couple of seconds, but very quickly you can forge a personal relationship with somebody, and that's often more rewarding than having wonderful Japanese-style efficient service in the first place. That's not always the case, and it's not always the case in Japan that you get wonderful efficient service either. So there's a lot of diversity there. But yeah, I suppose on the surface, Japanese society is very efficient, and it works incredibly well. But I wouldn't say that Malta is the opposite to that. You know, I go back to the UK a lot, and it drives me crazy just waiting for a train or getting anything done in the UK. So there's a huge spectrum of different ways of doing this.
Perhaps we exaggerate a bit our problems here in Malta, don't we?
Maybe.
What about food? Japanese food? Sometimes we hear of Japanese people eating Maltese, well, Maltese, but tuna caught around Malta. But my point is the food here in Malta. Anything you particularly liked or were impressed with? Very different from the local Japanese cuisine, for example. Although, of course, nowadays you can find standard Americanized food everywhere.
Yes, I mean, I love the fact that there's lots of cheese here, because in Japan there isn't a big cheese culture, and it's slowly changing. Farmers in Japan are slowly, beginning their own craft cheese kind of companies and things. But here in Malta, of course, there's the wonderful Gozien cheese and a lot of cheese from Italy and from all over Europe.
What about the fancata and the pastizzi and the Maltese food?
That reminds me a lot of the pasties, pastries remind me of some of my childhood in Britain, where pastries, Cornish pastries and those kind of things were very much part of the local culture. Mm-hmm. I found it to be a great place food-wise. I always enjoy discovering new places to eat, whether they be local shops, even in the three cities that would just sell pastries or something else, or very nice restaurants in Valletta or whatever. There's a huge range of things here. It's a real adventure.
Does it compare well, the choice with European destinations, for example?
I think so. Yeah. I really like what's on offer here. I do miss Japanese food, although there are places to have sushi. Japanese food, as it's experienced by Japanese people, is very different from you obviously can't find it everywhere, and some of the street food in Japan is not on sale anywhere in the world, let alone Malta. But there's a lot of diversity, isn't there, in Malta? I can have very good Indian food or Chinese food or whatever, so it's a good mix.
What about the things, anything you hate or can criticize or feel could be improved here in Malta?
Driving. if there was one pet hate, I was thinking actually driving here today that I get into the mindset where the only way to survive is to beat everybody else. So I've ended up driving like a maniac. And then I worked out, aha, that's what other people have been thinking. That's why they drive like maniacs. I think it's very difficult to have a small island where there are a lot of cars. People get into a kind of competitive mindset. And it's very frustrating to have so many cars on so few roads. So I think that would be an area that would change my day-to-day stress level if it was more regulated. And perhaps people, again, I'm not one to talk because I'm already in a mad zone myself, but if there was more discipline on the roads, perhaps that would make a difference to my day-to-day life. But having said that, I was not disciplined myself driving over here.
Because you came here in a rush, you mean?
Well, in a rush, but also with a sort of sense of frustration with the other drivers. And I think that I think we all think that about each other on the roads in Malta. Everybody's frustrated mm-hmm. with each other. And that's what leads to the lack of discipline, and it's a kind of vicious circle.
Have you experienced worse driving than Malta, or a similar type of driving as in Malta in other countries, or at the moment is Malta top of the list?
Well, Malta reminds me of Greece. I've driven a lot in Greece, and there's a similar sense of a kind of burning frustration slash aggression behind many of the drivers in Greece. I was looking actually to edit a book about this many years ago, Road Culture. I was going to edit it with a colleague, and we were going to have a chapter from a different society and analyze road culture, and we never did that in the end. But I do find it really interesting in terms of what it says about an important aspect of society and culture. But Malta is particularly interesting. Japan is actually not as polite as you would think
on the roads.
There's no society in my experience that gets it right.
And to conclude the program, Professor Bruce White, Professor of Anthropology, been living in Malta for the last year. Your plans for the future? Will Malta feature in them for a long time?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I decided to move here because of reasons connected to Malta's location and its position in social and political ways. I will continue that investment in this place. There are many advantages to operating internationally and having Malta as a base that are exciting and interesting, but as an anthropologist, it's also very enriching to be learning and becoming more assimilated and integrated into Maltese society. So to me, it's the best of many worlds. It's a base for international operations, but it's also a base where I can begin to understand the complexities and the richness of people here and make a life.
Professor Bruce White, thank you very much for being on Min Ajnejn Barranin.
Thank you.
U dik kienet edizzjoni oħra tal-programm Min Ajnejn Barranin. Il-programm jixxandar kull nhar ta' tlieta fit-tmienet ta' filgħaxija b'repetizzjoni l-ħamis fl-10 ta' filgħodu, kif ukoll tistgħu issibuh fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' Campus FM.